don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 20th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to talk about recent Democratic primary victories by left candidates, as well as the new developments in Israel and Palestine. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
So, Nate, you wanted to talk about some of the recent primary elections that have been happening in the United States as we head into the 2018 midterms. So we're recording this in sort of mid to late May at this point. What are some of the races that you wanted to highlight? Where do we start on this?
Right. Well, there was a bunch of primaries this past Tuesday. I think there's going to be some this coming Tuesday when this episode probably comes out. And then it's probably going to continue rolling. I think there's some scheduled mid-June. The recent one with the news about the recorded video or audio with Steny Hoyer. So I think that's Colorado 6. I think that's mid-June. On Tuesday, the Georgia gubernatorial primary is happening with the Stacey's, Evans versus Abrams.
That's happening. Saw some pretty rough ads from that one.
I think it is worth highlighting the results just this past Tuesday. All across the country, everywhere from Idaho, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, so all across the country in which...
I think we are going to talk more in depth about Idaho on a different episode because Rachel is not able to be on this week. The candidate that she had been supporting and talked about on the show previously was successful in that governor's primary.
Yeah, Paulette Jordan, just reading from The Nation here, Paulette Jordan is a new face of rural politics in America. A Native American woman is just nominated for governor of Idaho, winning big with a message that Democrats must reach out to rural and small town voters. And that was kind of a surprise, actually. We were sort of wondering if she was going to be able to defeat.
She got in very late in the race, you know, only several months ahead of the primary, and but she's pretty well known in progressive circles there. Illustrious career as a state representative, illustrious career on the, you know, in the indigenous politics there.
She's a member of the Coeur d'Alene tribe, and I believe descended from various other chiefs and people that at one point were fighting a war against the U.S. government, I believe. So going back into the history there, but. So we definitely want to talk with Rachel more about her, but it was worth noting that she did win that primary there. So in addition, we have a number of other races, including a lot of DSA-endorsed candidates who were able to win their primaries. Notably in Pennsylvania, we have an article here from Mother Jones, two socialists in Pennsylvania just won victories, Democrats can't ignore, and highlighting the defeat of the Costa cousins, I believe, Dom and Paul Costa, both incumbent state representatives. They were defeated by Sarah Inamorto, I believe, and Summer Lee, who are both members of Pittsburgh DSA. And so they were able to win in those primaries. And Dom Costa, he actually tried to do a write-in bid for the GOP ballot line. Doesn't seem like that was successful. His attempt fell short by about 24 votes. And so, yeah, it looks like, and it doesn't seem like there's going to be a Republican running in those seats. So these two DSA members were just apparently elected to the state legislature. So probably an improvement over the Costa Bros, longtime sort of conservative state representatives, things like that. So also we have in Nebraska, we have a reading here from Washington Post. The far left is winning the Democratic Civil War. So you have Nebraska.
So, of course, by far left, they mean just normal progressives.
Right,
basically.
Right. Well, yeah. In comparison. A liberal social worker and political neophyte who built her campaign around Medicare for All scored a shocking upset in the Democratic primary to take on Don Bacon. Kara Eastman, 45, beat former Congressman Brad Ashford, 68, in an Omaha area district that National Democrats believed they could pick up in November. Eastman advocated for universal background checks to buy guns, raising taxes, and decriminalizing marijuana. "I'm tired of hearing Democrats don't have a backbone, that we don't stand for anything," she said in a commercial that touted her support for universal health care. "That changes now." And Ashford, of course, had the full-throated support of the DCCC, and including a number of pro-choice groups that perhaps had the different view of, I believe, his former state representative mate, Heath Mello. There was that blow up over the Omaha mayoral race.
He was running for mayor of Omaha, and like Sanders, you know, went, I guess, to do a thing for the DNC to support him. And then it was like, well, he was like supporting mandatory ultrasound bills in the legislature or something like that. And this, well, you know, why does Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez, the DNC chair, why do they not care about, you know, pro-choice issues or whatever? And then it turns out, no, actually, he supported a voluntary ultrasound thing in an attempt to try to like block or prevent a mandatory bill that was going through. You know, and then this other guy, what's the name of his friend? Ashford, you said. So he's a former congressman. I think he was one term maybe or two terms or something in Congress. And he's coming back for another bite at the apple. I looked up about him, though, because people were referring to him as a former Republican. So he, like, had been a Democrat, and then he was a Republican for a long time, and then he was an independent in the state house for a while, and then he switched to the Democrats right before running for Congress, and then he got elected to Congress, and he was there for a little bit. But like, he's a pretty darn conservative Democrat, and
he ran in the Republican primary in 94.
Yeah, so, and like, that was, you know, 94, wasn't that the Contract with America year, like the Gingrich Revolution year or whatever? So then now he's, you know, he's quote-unquote Democrat, pretty conservative, and, you know, It's not without precedent at all, I will say, but disconcerting still, nonetheless, to see groups like Emily's List supporting a conservative male Democrat who's not even an incumbent over a progressive woman who is running a good campaign, clearly, because she won the primary. You know, I mean, I would say it's probably even worse than the time that they supported. Emily's List supported an anti-choice woman. Well, I don't know if it's hard to say which is worse. Anyway, they supported an anti-choice woman running in Tennessee against the incumbent congressman Steve Cohen, the Jewish congressman from the majority minority district, who had you know, gotten in there in like a huge multi-way primary or whatever the previous year or the previous cycle, and they supported this like anti-choice woman against him, even though he voted how they wanted on every single bill in Congress. And now they're, you know, now in Nebraska supporting this conservative, basically right wing Democratic congressman against a progressive woman. You know, I mean, it's just, what are they doing?
Like, didn't they recently have to be shamed into supporting the challenger to Lipinski?
Oh yeah, that's right. That was that whole thing too. Like, there was a bunch of the national groups that weren't supporting the woman, Marie Newman, I think her name was, who was running against Dan Lipinski and very narrowly lost that primary. And that's one where, like, he was handed that seat by his dad, and he and his dad were both like really anti-abortion Democrats, like very much voting to restrict abortion rights in Congress. And I think Lipinski even voted against the Affordable Care Act. And they would, you know, these groups were that, not getting behind Newman.
And
to support
if they
her.
Had earlier,
right, she probably would have won. Yeah.
And apparently now I saw from was Elsa Hoag on Twitter. She was talking about, oh, they'll have to consider whether to support Eastman in the general, because, oh, we can't just throw money around everywhere. So, like, what are they even doing? It's unclear. But also, there were some other races in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, where GOP Rep. Charlie Dent's retirement created a winnable open seat for Democrats. Early frontrunner John Morganelli, a district attorney who'd been locally prominent for decades, lost the primary to attorney Susan Wild, who ran at him from the left. Morganelli, who opposes abortion rights and sanctuary cities, was attacked relentlessly on the airwaves for speaking positive about Trump and tweeting he was open to taking a job in the administration during the transition. So kind of seems like he hung himself there with his own words. That's interesting.
Going to just comment about the because you were saying about Charlie Dent retiring. So as you said, this is the district in Pennsylvania where this it was, we should emphasize, pro-choice Republican, one of the last few pro-choice Republican. This year, Charlie Dent retiring, this Morganelli got, they thought it was going to be like he was supposed to be the Democratic frontrunner, you know, this DA who's, you know, been this longtime fixture in politics, Morganelli, who is anti-choice. And you might think, okay, well, that's a weird anomaly. No, in 2016, my friend who was working in Lehigh Valley area as an organizer on the coordinated campaign said that the Democrat who ran last time in which I think was Rick Dougherty or something like that, or Dougherty, get like 38% of the vote or something. An anti-choice man running on the Democratic ticket last time as well. And he said that they had volunteers coming in to their field offices, you know, and they're supposed to pick up literature for like all the candidates from, you know, president on downward and everything. And they refused to carry literature for the congressional candidate because it's all these, you know, women who are, you know, like 50s and 60s and so on, who are coming in enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. And they were like, look, I don't like the Republicans, but there's no way that I'm voting for an anti-choice Democrat over a pro-choice moderate Republican in this district. And it was like, all you had to do was put a pro-choice Democrat on the ballot that year, and like you would have been able to get like another seat picked up probably, because they won that area. You know, it didn't go that well in the rest of Pennsylvania, I guess, but they won that area. Like, they probably could have pulled that off, or at least come very close. And that, you know, Dent got like 58% or something this time. So now Dent's retiring, and who did the Democrat establishment try to put up in that equivalent seat this time? They put up this anti-choice Morganelli guy. Fortunately, gets defeated, as you mentioned, by this woman.
Right. So here's another example of sort of the trend we're talking about here. In the Philadelphia suburbs, centrist Rachel Reddick, a 33-year-old Navy veteran endorsed by Emily's List, lost the Democratic primary to take on Brian Fitzpatrick after proud progressive Scott Wallace ran ads attacking her for being a registered Republican until 2016. So
yeah, this is the people that they keep bringing in as recruits for these races.
Also a ton of like intelligence veterans, CIA people, veterans, right? So Wallace, 66, is the grandson of Henry Wallace, who is Franklin Roosevelt's vice president for a term and then ran against Harry Truman after he got dumped off the convention in 48. We've talked about this on the program before. And of course, Henry Wallace.
44, I think, right?
Right. Well, yeah, then he ran in 40. Right, anyway, right. Yeah. But Henry Wallace is actually interesting because his father was also agriculture secretary for, I believe, Hoover and Coolidge. Or no, for Coolidge and like the battle with Hoover and sort of like this progressive Republican tradition that he comes out of, and then was the nominee for the Progressive Party. And apparently, actually, I was just reading a little bit of like historical documentation or whatever, and people were like, whenever he would show up to speak, there would be like angry people trying to like no platform him, saying that, oh, he's pinko or whatever.
Like Stalin sent him or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's sort of interesting. I did see he got attacked by,
the grandson,
Wallace, who he's a, patriotic millionaire. He has a ton of money, and sort of has that framing, which, you know, is potentially problematic, but at the same time, it seems like he was giving away a decent amount of money to, activist organizations. And then apparently he gave some money to Code Pink. Then Code Pink supported boycott, divestment, sanctions. So now he's being attacked for supporting BDS, even though he does not support BDS. So it's kind of one of those things. But yeah, we'll see if that actually has an impact in the general or whatnot. But so there was that. John Fetterman, I believe, beat the incumbent lieutenant governor, Mike Stack, supported by Bernie Sanders, stumping for him across the state. Fetterman campaigned on universal health care and legalizing marijuana. So there's that there.
Yeah, so Fetterman's a really impressive guy who ran. I think he was running for U.S. Senate in 2016. And was it like Katie McGinty, I want to say, got the nomination? And it was just like a really lackluster candidate who kind of fell apart and didn't in the general election and you know, also didn't win against Toomey. But like Fetterman's, you know, this like, you know, solid progressive dude, but like also willing to work with everyone in the party. Like he's not, you know, he's not one like an exclusionary person or whatever like that. You know, really trying hard to turn around these sort of post-industrial Rust Belt towns or like where he's been the mayor of in Braddock. But he's this like enormous guy, like well over 6 feet tall, huge guy.
He's got arm tattoos
all over and everything. But yeah, so it looks like he's going to be the lieutenant governor probably because he defeated the sitting lieutenant governor in the primary. So he has a pretty good shot of being the lieutenant governor, it looks like.
Right. So there's that. And then circling back to the Pittsburgh area races, just a little more detail about some of them. I believe Summer Lee was profiled in the New Yorker. And I believe she'll become the first African-American woman elected to the state legislature from southwestern Pennsylvania. And so they're getting write-ups and as well as Imamoro. So that's happening. And, NPR articles about them, they took out what it seems like the sort of a local political dynasty. And then now they're people are basically forced to talk about them because that's happening in the real world. So a third legislative candidate backed by the group, Kareem Candeel, lost a three-way Democratic primary north of Pittsburgh. Still, University of Pittsburgh political science professor Kristen Karthank said after Tuesday, you should expect to see big changes in terms of what the Democratic Party in Allegheny looks like. And I think this is an example, you know, not all of these candidates are going to win, but the fact that they are running and they are winning in some cases, or at least being competitive, sort of changed the material reality of on the ground and who sort of the Democratic Party base is actually looking towards and who they think they can support. And, yeah,
I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of misunderstanding about the Republican, like right-wing takeover of the Republican Party over the last 10 years or so. Like there's many lessons that the Democrats learned that were incorrect. Obviously the big one, thinking that because a few of the moderates got unseated in their primaries in 2010 and then the right-wing candidate lost the general election, that meant that was a failed model when in fact they took over all branches of power.
It's like, look where the Republicans are right now.
Right. And in many cases, some of those guys, like, for example, Ken Buck, you know, narrowly lost the U.S. Senate race in 2010 because he's this real extreme candidate. And then he gets elected in 2014, I think, as a congressional candidate in a smaller bet, like a more favorable district. And that Democrat got, I mean, and then the Republicans did pick up the one of the Senate seats that year with a somewhat more moderate Republican, but, you know, only by comparison. Like, for the most part, they, you know, it took them a few cycles in some cases, but like they got everything they wanted and with the people they wanted for the most part. So that's like one lesson that was mislearned. But the other thing is like, one of the things that the Republicans sort of figured out is like, what really matters in most cases is winning that primary. Because if you win that primary, then everyone sort of like in the party or whatever is coalescing behind you against this, you know, whoever they put up on the other side, you're going to call them too extreme or whatever. And you've got that enthusiasm going because you picked someone that, you know, the base actually wanted. And in many cases, the base, especially in the, you know, the areas that are more dominated by Republicans, the Democratic Party base is this more populist progressive base. It doesn't necessarily look exactly the same as the progressive base in other parts of the Democratic Party geographically, but like, for the most part, especially in, you know, these prairie states and places like that, or in the Rust Belt or whatever, these populist appeals are going to be what actually motivates people to show up to vote. It's going to create a clear distinction between these candidates so that people aren't picking between a Republican and a probably former Republican who has almost the same positions. And they're going to, like, that's what's going to actually motivate people to show up, to work hard. And maybe most importantly for the Democratic Party, and this is not necessarily true for the Republican Party, which tends to pay everyone, the Democrats rely heavily on volunteer turnout. That was a huge issue for the Democratic Party in 2016, in many cases, including at the top of the ticket, was having trouble getting people to volunteer their time, energy, and effort. And, like, I'm not trying to slam Hillary Clinton here or whatever, but, like, the fact that she was this very heavily well-funded insider establishment candidate meant that you even had shortages in many cases of enough volunteer housing to host the volunteers that you were bringing
in. Or even
in.
Things like clipboards, just basic literature. They were forcing people to buy those with out of their own money.
So they were short on money at the level where they needed it. They were short on volunteer resources. They were short on, like, housing for volunteers, transportation for volunteers.
They were telling people to go back.
And,
like, when they were trying to go canvass in Michigan or whatever.
So the, like, having that enthusiastic and engaged volunteer base and the, you know, people stepping up to be these, you know, thankless field organizer positions and stuff like that, that's like, you need the exciting candidate that's going to motivate people to do that. If we're talking about something, you know, comparing, like, Kara Eastman to Brad Ashford, like, that's not a hard contest. Like, it's going to be a lot harder to win that race with Ashford against the right-wing Republican than it would be if you actually got an exciting Democrat that connects with not only the Democratic Party base there, which is Plains populism, but also a lot of more independent and conservative voters even. There's a lot of people who want that populism. That's the heart of populism. The populist party was from Nebraska. Well, not from, but, like, had their base of support in Nebraska for a long time. That's where William Jennings Bryan is from. Like, this legacy is still there. These positions are still there. If you want to be able to win these races, in some cases, you're going to have to go in a more populist, progressive direction, even in a quote-unquote conservative area. It does not follow that because it's a so-called conservative area that you have to nominate a conservative Democrat in order to be able to win. That's the Republicans figured out that they could win a lot of races in areas that weren't necessarily that right-wing, even with a right-wing nominee. That's what they figured out.
Yeah, just quickly touching on the Hillary thing, some of the excerpts from the Chasing Hillary book that have been posted on Twitter, the Kate Reed's Books account, highlighting this, doing a great service. She was basically off the trail, and I believe you posted at the time about this, Bill, on Twitter, that she was off the trail, like, in the Hamptons, just doing these fundraising events. People were asking within her campaign, like, does she even want to be president? What's going on?
There was a month where they just disappeared and didn't do any events. Yeah. And at the time, I was like, I guess maybe this strategy makes sense. Like, it keeps
her from
making...
But if they were raising money and then not spending the money...
Well, also, it was... Well, they were spending it on, like, TV and staff and, like, yeah, high-level, like, staff, like, consultants, as opposed to, like...
On ads in Georgia and California
as opposed, yeah, as opposed to providing clipboards or whatever. But, No, I mean, the thing I remember thinking at the time, I was like, well, maybe if this keeps her from making, like, gaffes, then she'll just keep her lead or whatever. But then it turns out that stuff like the deplorables thing or whatever, like, that was stuff that she was saying at, like, donor events in the Hamptons and that kind of thing. And then it got, you know, out to the general public accidentally or something. And then next thing you know, that blows up. And it's like, so it didn't even prevent her from making these gaffes. And I don't even know why I thought it would, because the same thing happened with Mitt Romney. Like, he took that, like, you know, August 47%. Break to go do the fundraising. Yeah. And says the 47% of Americans are, like, takers, not makers, and aren't contributing anything. And it's like, come on, man. Like,
right. And so to circle to the point where we're talking about sort of the centrist Democratic fears, we were just watching Neera Tanden talk about this on the news.
Head of Center for American Progress, for those
right.
who don't know.
She's somewhat impaired during her speech. But anyway, she was, and this is the point that gets talked about a lot. They point to, like, what, Christine O'Donnell, you know, I am not a witch.
Right.
And that whole debacle. But these are not the people that are running and winning these, like, local DSA seats or whatever. So, for example, Lee, initially supported Bernie Sanders in 2016 election, but graduating from Howard Law School, she moved home to organize for Hillary Clinton. Then last spring, a scandal erupted in Woodland Hills High School after officials were caught on tape threatening and assaulting African-American students. Lee decided to use her organizing skills to target what she saw as the racism of the school board, which is almost entirely white. Quarter of whom are African-American in the district. She got involved with running African-American candidates for open seats on the board. They won, and she took up work as a paid organizer around progressive issues. then she was approached by a DSA to see if she wanted to run, and basically she was debating on it, but it seemed like the success of Doug Jones and the black woman who pushed him over the top basically said, we need to run. So she decided to do it. I believe Imamoto, she had been involved with, you know, she, I think her father, she lost her father to opioid abuse and addiction. And basically she was working on a women's leadership fellowship program, involved in a podcast. She runs Southwestern Pennsylvania, talking with women candidates. And it's like, these are the backgrounds of these candidates who are running. These aren't the sort of Christine O'Donnell's just like absolute craziness. And like, what was it? The chickens, was the Medicare chickens person that was Nevada,
which she didn't even win the primary. I right, always get confused. Yeah. Cause that was like, because Sharon Angle was the one who got the nomination, and she was also kind of nuts.
Yeah, but okay, like, that's what I'm thinking.
But the
that
one,
race.
But the one who said that, you know, you can barter chickens for healthcare, like, was supposed to be the moderate, like, Republican that was supposed to win that race, and it was like, so they both would have lost. Like,
yeah, Imamoto was entered an Apple retail management program and became active with neighborhood organizations focused on housing. She transitioned to nonprofit work. And founded a consulting firm that provides communications and other services to local governments, charities, and activist organizations. So these are the people that are running, not the Christine O'Donnell types. And as an example of what was defeated, the man she challenged, Dom Costa, was first elected to the State House in 2008 and is well known for his career in law enforcement, which culminated in 2006 with a 9-month stint as Pittsburgh chief of police. So this guy was literally chief of police. 1997, this is the interesting part, Costa was formally reprimanded for his role in an incident which fumes escaped from an abandoned house that SWAT team members were using for tear gas training, sending at least 17 residents of the predominantly African-American neighborhood to hospitals and sparking a federal civil rights suit. So they basically tear gassed a bunch of African-Americans while doing SWAT training. So that's Costa.
One race that I wanted to talk about before we go to the next segment was Dan Cannon in Indiana. He lost his primary, unfortunately, a couple weeks ago. He was a really interesting candidate, running against this real, real stupid Republican incumbent who's been on there for like maybe one or two terms at this point, and like, you know, moved from Kentucky or something to run for this seat that his dad spent like $10 million on ads, like getting him in, you know, getting him elected a couple cycles ago or whatever. But Dan Cannon is this pretty high profile civil rights attorney, representing a lot of people on like medical marijuana access cases for like really serious, you know, cancer patients and things like that. Representing gay couples in Kentucky against that clerk that didn't want to give out the licenses.
Kim Davis.
Yeah, and representing various like immigrant rights cases. So there's a lot of interesting interviews out there with Dan Cannon talking about a lot of the work that he's done, which is really important and interesting stuff that he'll continue doing even though he's not going to be in Congress. But one legacy that I think his campaign is going to leave behind, and I'll be keeping an eye on that, I think, in November, is that he, when he was organizing his campaign, you know, it's this like, I think, 7 counties or something like that in this congressional district in Indiana. He had these field organizers that were supposed to be, you know, organizing these specific areas of the district. And they realized that the Democrats had not found anybody to run for any of these state legislature seats, basically, except maybe the one that was representing the college town that was in his district. And then they start looking through the, you know, district history and realize that the Democrats haven't run anybody against these state legislator Republicans in, you know, many, many years. And so these field organizers then decided to pull papers themselves to run for the state rep seats that they were organizing for his campaign. So I don't know how many of them did that, but I think it was at least a few of them. And it will be interesting to see, you know, maybe like, because I don't think they were contested in the Democratic primaries. It'll be interesting to see if a bunch of his organizers end up, you know, winning in November because they actually put in the effort and have been working all year on these districts. And that could potentially happen. And that would be really exciting to see. And that, I think, is really important. You know, I mean, speaking as someone who lost a campaign, like, the most important thing you can do when running a campaign, if you might, you know, if you're going to lose or something, if you have to end up losing, is make sure you leave something behind that you've been building up.
Yeah, and I think this sort of speaks to the two different types of Democratic state parties that we've sort of talked about, either the ones that are sort of the all-powerful machine, sort of like here in Massachusetts or in other heavily Democratic states, or other areas where the party is basically atrophied and they're not running anyone in a lot of these races, and it's actually possible to sort of just co-opt them, take them over, even if you don't win an initial race just because it's a conservative area or whatever. You can keep sort of building that momentum, and maybe eventually you sneak a couple local election victories in there and then start to build something. So who knows?
And we certainly saw from Virginia in last year's off-cycle election that you can even unseat Republican leadership members if they've, you know, never been challenged and it's a small enough district. You know, run an actual competent campaign and get out there on the doors, and you might be able to take them out, because in many cases, no one's run against them in like 20 years or something. They don't know how to run for re-election in a contested race. And they, you know, they might win like, you know, huge margins if they're normally against some token opposition, but if they're against actual opposition, they may end up losing. It's in many cases, these districts are not that large. So hopefully that we'll see more of that happening.
Right. Although what we did learn from Robbie Mook, who ran the Hillary campaign, is they don't believe that they can actually convince people.
That's the most wrong thing that came out of that entire campaign, was Robbie Mook being like, the data shows that you can't persuade people, which is absolutely false. I mean, and a lot of the canvassing is like getting, obviously, yeah, it is getting people out who already support you, but a lot of it is like, hey, did you know there was a race happening here? Like, do you want to come out and vote for us? Like, this is what we're all about. Like, it absolutely works. There's so much evidence that it works. That's such a lie.
Yeah, and I mean, it's pretty clear that a lot of these establishment Democratic consultants or whatever, they just don't seem to understand politics on an extremely fundamental level. So, I mean, maybe that sort of speaks to, like, they believe that offering people things is like bribing them. They were like, yeah, oh, Bernie's bribing the youth with free college and stuff. And
it's like, yeah, he's offering to deliver services and then programs that people want to people who need them and might vote if they get stuff. Like, that's how politics works. That's what politics is. What's wrong with you? Anyway, all right, we're going to go to a quick break, and then we'll be back from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. So please stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. Nate, you wanted to talk about some of the stuff that's been going on in Gaza and some of the discourse around that. Get us rolling on that.
Yeah, well, this has sort of been ongoing for the past couple weeks, it seems like. It seems like there was a flare-up maybe like 2 weeks ago, and then with the moving the, I guess, embassy, technically, consulate or whatever, for the U.S. into Jerusalem. You had, Kushner go over there, I believe, and that was sort of interesting, a split screen where Kushner is celebrating the opening, as well as Ivanka, I believe, of the embassy. And then you also have, you know, the scenes at the Gaza border fence area. So, you know, there's a lot of coverage around that. And then, of course, there was that big flare-up in the earlier part of this where Natalie Portman said that she was canceling a trip to Israel. Natalie Portman, of course, being Israeli-born, probably one of the most famous Israelis, certainly in popular media or wherever. So the fact that she said that she didn't want to go, in general, I think she's quite supportive of Israel, has said that she doesn't want to criticize it, but has also said that she's criticizing Netanyahu, for instance.
Yeah, and this, like, the event, I think that she was going to be on the same stage with Netanyahu or something.
Right, so I think it was like the Israeli Nobel Prize or whatever.
So she didn't want to go.
Right, and I mean, this is just sort of a signaling effect where, you know, someone like her, who's in general quite supportive of Israel, sort of this liberal Zionist worldview, basically couldn't deal with it. And there's a lot of talk about how this is potentially a turning point for sort of liberal Zionists. There's an article, we can talk about that in a second. But I did just want to highlight a couple things from New York Times. So a Dallas evangelical pastor who once said that Jewish people are going to hell, and a megachurch televangelist who claimed that Hitler was part of God's plan to return Jews to Israel, both played prominent roles on Monday in the opening ceremony of the new American embassy in Jerusalem. So Robert Jeffress spoke at President Trump's private inaugural prayer service and is the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, delivered a prayer at the opening ceremony on Monday, while Reverend John Hagee, televangelist who founded Christians United for Israel and leads a San Antonio megachurch, gave the closing benediction. So this is sort of a trend we've been seeing for many decades now. Sort of these Christian Zionists who are extremely, they have basically questionable views on the future of the Jewish people, but apparently if they support Israel, they're fine. So that's interesting, a little juxtaposition there when you have Kushner and Ivanka over there. Jeffers, you can't be saved by being a Jew. Islam is wrong and is a heresy from the pit of hell. Mormonism is wrong and is a heresy from the pit of hell. He added, Judaism, you can't be saved by being a Jew. You know who said that? By the way, the three greatest Jews in the New Testament, Peter, Paul, and Jesus Christ. They all said Judaism won't do it. It's faith in Jesus Christ. So he's a Fox News talking head. So, you know, he's Hagee also said that Hurricane Katrina punished New Orleans for its sins. So, I've heard about that before. Yeah.
Real charmer. Yeah. Fulfilling the biblical prophecy that we all know and love, that the United States needs to move its diplomatic corps to a different building in a different city within a country in the Middle East.
Also, he said Mitt Romney is part of a cult. So that's, I remember because Hagee popped up in the 2008 race because he supported McCain, and McCain had to disavow his endorsement because of, basically in the late 90s, Hitler said that the Bible made clear that Hitler and the Holocaust were part of God's plan to return Jews to Israel. How did it happen? Because God allowed it to happen, he said, referring to the Holocaust. Why did it happen? Because God said my top priority for the Jewish people is to get them back to the land of Israel. And I think he said also stuff about like Hitler being a hunter and like God wants hunters or something. It's extremely bizarre, but they do have this sort of, you know, Book of Revelation apocalyptic worldview, which says, you know, there's going to be some select Jews, I guess, taken up to heaven with them if they convert or whatever. The rest will be wiped out. There's something involving a red heifer. I don't know. And then, yeah, there's all stuff about like, they interpret like Russia is going to be somehow involved in Syria. So then some of this gets tied up in the Syrian war. But also these guys are very anti-gay. Should not really need to specify that because that's sort of baked into their worldview there. Jeffress made national news in 1998 when he refused to return two books about children with gay parents to the city's library. So this is sort of the guys that they're associating with themselves there. Meanwhile, I don't know the entire count now about the victims in Gaza, but I believe the dead are dozens and possibly the wounded up to a couple thousand now at this point, because you just had snipers sort of in a sort of fortified, sort of like a hill, I think they're up on, and they're just basically sniping, taking people out, or like shooting people in the legs. That's a tactic, often leads a lot to amputations. So we've seen that for a while in this Gaza area, sort of a large, basically open-air prison. And, you know, I did see the IDF posted something where they were displaying the various weapons that Hamas were supposedly using against them, because all the dead are Hamas. That's what we've been told. But there's like...
obviously not true.
Yeah, but... arson kites. So like a kite is on fire. I don't exactly know how that's going to do arson. It's going to land on something, and then, so unclear, but then, of course, you know, rock throwing or whatever. They're trying to take down the fence with, like, a rope. That was one of the things. It's, like, it's extremely difficult for me to actually see, like, who this is supposed to, like, strike fear into or whatever. But as long as they throw stuff out there, they can essentially get people to support that.
Well, there was that New York Times op-ed that was just like, the Israelis were completely right and justified in doing what they did.
Yeah, well, when you have a lineup of Tom Freeman, Barry Weiss, Brett Stevens, David Brooks, we're not really going to get a nuanced, balanced, accurate take on that. So I did want to note the response from congressional Democrats as well. Splinter news from Wednesday this week. Israeli troops shot and killed dozens of Palestinians protesting the border fence. In response, the White House has blamed the massacre squarely at the feet of Gaza's Hamas government. And across the aisle, Democrats have been conspicuously silent about the violence. So they asked a bunch of 2020 possible candidates, and only Bernie Sanders, Andrew Cuomo, and Elizabeth Warren gave them statements. I did see a lot of people getting mad at Sanders' statement because he mentioned after the wounded toll, casualty toll, he said this is a staggering toll. Hamas violence does not justify Israel firing on unarmed protesters. People were basically upset. Why did you even throw Hamas violence in there? That's not really why Israel's firing on unarmed protesters. In compared to, say, Cuomo and Warren's statement, of course, Cuomo said he was actually going to go over there. It's not entirely clear what Andrew Cuomo himself would be able to do. But so there was basically no response from Biden, Gillibrand, Booker, Harris, Holder, Castro, Patrick, or Eric Garcetti. So probably some of the likely candidates in there. No response. So there you go. Yeah. Basically, that's the situation there. You also have, I believe there's the Canadian doctor recently shot. He was being interviewed on Democracy Now. Sometimes you have medics going up to people trying to bring them back, and Israeli forces were like beating up the medics. So that was happening. And, you know, this is just the situation that is almost all too common, it seems like, because there was Nakba Day, there was the March of Return, and then it just kind of seems like this is like simmering. And of course, going back to 2008, you had Israel hold off on, what was it, Protective Edge or Cast Lead or whatever, right after Obama was inaugurated. Then they stopped right as he was about to be inaugurated, I believe, because they didn't want to.
It's in January, yeah. Like during the lame duck period.
So that's the situation there. And now we talked a little bit about Natalie Portman situation, where people got extremely upset as a result of that. And basically, they were accusing her of like leaving Israel at the altar. Like a lot of these like extremely gendered, like sexist language.
It's very bizarre, too, because she made very explicit that she is still a Zionist who does not support.
Yeah,
boycott,
but even any deviation will result in this sort of denunciation, you know, self-hating Jew, whatnot. And so do want to read a little here by in Jewish Currents, recently founded sort of a leftist progressive Jewish magazine. The Jewish embassy ceremony was liberal Zionism's funeral by Joshua Liefer. And he talks about how, you know, by the end of the day, Israeli forces had killed 58 Palestinians, wounded over 2,700, Gaza's bloodiest day since the 2014 war. And this is while, you know, Netanyahu's taking the podium for the embassy ceremony. Deeply moved to be here, Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, tweeted along with a selfie from inside the ceremony. And, you know, Rabbi Rick Jacobs was also there, president of the Union for Reform Judaism. You know, he expressed concern by the growing number of Gazan dead and wounded, but could not resist condemning the Hamas leadership for encouraging incitement on the border with Israel, as if Hamas's involvement with the Great Return March, which began largely as an independent popular resistance initiative, somehow justified the Israeli army's use of live ammunition against unarmed civilians. Bittersweet was the strongest condemnation of the mass killings in Gaza that the Brookings Institution's Martin Indyk could muster. Indyk is a former U.S. special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian relations. And so this is sort of highlighting how, you know, you have these liberal Zionist organizations basically just throwing a little bit like, oh, there were some wounded, but oh, Hamas, so both sides, whatever. It is now a truism that liberal Zionists, given the choice between liberalism and Zionism, choose Zionism no matter how liberal a form it takes. These statements by Greenblatt, Indyk, and Jacobs, all in some sense mainstream liberal Zionist leaders, are simply a reflection of this, but taken together, their statements also indicate new contours of the politics of Israel-Palestine in the Trump era. And also talks about, yeah, the anti-Semitic pastors who are there. Like many of Trump's policy decisions, moving the embassy did not mark a change in the status quo as much as its unmasking. That's a good point there. The end of the illusion that the U.S. is an honest broker between Israel and the Palestinians. The end of the farce that liberal Zionism is, in practice, anything other than an excuse for controlling and killing Palestinians. The end of American Jewish leadership's lip service about human rights. It is particularly telling in Rabbi Jacob's statement that the only reference to rights is a sentence about Israel's right, even obligation, to defend itself. Palestinians, it seems, do not have any rights worth mentioning.
I was going to say, because you mentioned in there, in that quote, that talking about the sort of end of the farce of the United States as this, like, you know, neutral broker or something in this, which it used to be, right? I mean, it used to be a lot more balanced in between the two. Between the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, and help negotiate a number of treaties with the Israel and the other countries. But one thing that I thought was notable, and obviously part of the coverage was shaped by the fact that there were these protests happening and people being gunned down by the Israeli Defense Forces and Border Patrol, Border Police at the so-called border, which isn't really a border, but, you know, the internal line between Israel proper and the Gaza territory. There wasn't that much discussion, I felt like, about the significance of the embassy move in terms of its impact on any potential future treaties or peace negotiations or anything. Like, in the past, anytime this has come up, the reason that it was not moved, the reason that the U.S. was based at the consulate in Tel Aviv rather than at an embassy in Jerusalem, even though they had purchased the land and building quite a while ago, was because it was supposed to be a bargaining chip, right? You know, to keep the Israelis as part of the negotiations, to keep, you know, that you would trade various things, one of which would be, we will agree to move the embassy to Israel, I mean, to Jerusalem, as long as there's this, you know, final deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians or whatever, and resolving the status of Jerusalem as a whole, which has been a thorny thing because both countries would like at least part or all of it for capitals.
Yeah, and there's proposals floated like, oh, the UN's going to do something with it, or there's going to be a negotiated
I did a speech about a UN sort of neutral area proposal for 10th grade or whatever when we had to do those speeches in English class. But anyway, I think it's noteworthy, though, that there was almost no discussion in the discourse, so to speak, around all of this regarding the fact that that bargaining chip is gone now and that nothing was traded for it. And I don't know, you know, again, maybe that's just because of all the Gaza stuff that was happening, but I kind of think that a lot of that, like, non-discussion of that reflects this sort of growing sense that, like, the peace process is pretty much dead and that it's not going anywhere and it's not viable anymore because the settlements are so large and expansive at this point that there isn't much of a viable, you know, nation state territory left, and there's going to be a water crisis soon as well, and just sort of all these things compounding on top of each other, and it's like, is there an actual negotiation? And one of the things that also is probably dead with liberal Zionism is that sort of the core of the liberal Zionism version was agreeing to this so-called two-state solution, that there was going to be these two distinct states, and the right-wing Zionist position is that there's not going to be two states because there's just going to be one huge Israeli-Jewish state, and then and it's going to cover everything. And I think even some of the, like, logos for some of the parties, like, extend all the way into Jordan as what they depict Israel as opposed to just into the territories. But, you know, this liberal Zionist notion that there's going to be this distinct two states thing, it's just not really viable anymore at this point. And people more to the left of that perspective are sort of coming around to the realization that probably realistically what's going to happen is there's going to be one state that's going to be a binational state. This is the best case scenario we're talking about, not the right wing vision where it's just, you know, this autocracy basically that's enforcing sort of the power structure or whatever that's already there de facto. But the, like, the leftier version, the best case scenario is that you negotiate a peaceful, coexistent, binational state. Also hard to see how that exactly is going to work, given the sort of gradual suppression of liberal and left factions within the Israeli population, taking away a lot of their rights as well. I mean, this is, it should be noted that even setting aside the Palestinian context, the government, the cabinet that is in power right now in Israel with Likud and the Jewish Home Party, which is one of the settlements parties, and a bunch of these other ones, but especially Netanyahu and Jewish Home, that cabinet is very, very, very right-wing, even domestically within Israel proper. So we're not even talking about settlements. We're not even talking about the Palestinian situation. The actual, like, within Israel, for Israelis, for Jewish Israelis, they are an extraordinarily right-wing government that is taking away most of the democracy, such as there is, in Israel. The Israeli democracy for the Jewish Israelis is being stripped away by this government, and it's hard to see how that's going to work in future under any.
I was looking at the Knesset breakdown a couple months ago. I don't even think Labor, like, exists anymore or is represented at all.
I think they're renamed as, yeah, like, and not Zionist that, you know, something now.
Labor was effectively or really a left-wing party at all, but, you know, that sort of speaks to that. Did want to finish reading from this essay about the American Jewish context. There was some protests by If Not Now, which is a Jewish organization here in America supporting Palestinians. So protests in the U.S. against American Jewish communities' support for the occupation appear to be having their intended effect. American Jews will likely remember the grotesque split-screen spectacle of the glitzy embassy ceremony side-by-side footage of the mass shooting in Gaza for years to come. There is, however, a risk of the rhetoric of moral responsibility for Israel's crimes obscuring the geopolitics that made them possible. This is also a kind of trap for diaspora Jewish activists whose insistence on their own moral imperative to oppose the Jewish state's policy ends up confirming Israel as singularly representative for all Jews, incorporating anti-occupation and Palestine solidarity. Organizing into a broader politics of anti-militarism and anti-imperialism could help avoid these pitfalls. After all, America's support for murderous governments and its own murderous policies abroad do not begin and end with Israel. While the organized American Jewish community certainly facilitated this special relationship between Israel and the United States, American support for Israel has more to do with the U.S.'s imperial interest in maintaining a foothold in the Middle East than a deep felt concern for the future of Jewish people. And, you know, sort of closes on this essay basically saying the moving of the U.S. Embassy with Jared Kushner, Ambassador David Friedman, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin filling in for Kissinger, made the choice between these two paradigms of Jewishness and the paradigms he's talking about sort of contrasting Trotsky and Kissinger. Made the choice between these two paradigms of Jewishness starker than ever, and by attempting to stand up in the crumbling center, liberal Zionists have sided with empire. For the rest of us, the choice remains, will we be imperialists or will we be revolutionaries? So that's Joshua Liefer, associate editor of Plus 972 magazine, which is also good. So, I mean, that sort of speaks to what we're talking about here. There's not a lot of, and a lot of people, even around here, they're sort of very much in that liberal Zionist center. And, you know, there's concern about human rights, but at the same time, Israel has a right to defend itself. So we're basically not really going to criticize them. But that position does not appear to be shared with a younger generation of, you know, sort of millennial Jews and many other people in this generation. So there's internal debate over this issue, and the scenes from Gaza sort of serve as a sort of clarifying or sharpening visual for all of this. So just want to talk about that.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for being here this week.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.